This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect our office's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in these three fields, all in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on the current trends and issues facing the Garden State. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dean Rada from the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. And today I'm joined by Lisbeth van der Heide, who is a research fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism at The Hague. At the ICCT, she coordinates their activities in the field of counterterrorism in prison, a project that focuses on prisons in North Africa and Southeast Asia, and includes implementing threat and risk assessment measures to identify and assess violent extremism. She also works as a researcher and lecturer at the Institute of Security and Global Affairs in Leiden University since 2011. And we asked Lisbeth to be here today to talk about a research paper that she authored or co-authored in late August called Children of the Caliphate. So, Lisbeth, welcome for joining us. We had some technical problems arranging for this, but thank you very much for sticking with us.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
And if you could begin by talking a little bit about your role at ICCT and your research fields in a little more depth.
Yeah, of course. Well, you summed it up quite nicely. So I have two jobs. One is at ICCT, and that one focuses mainly on other countries and on implementing and doing capacity building. So implementing programs, setting up training workshops. And all of my work in that field has centered on working in prisons and dealing with the question of what do you do when you've got violent extremist offenders in prison. And that has, I started doing that in 2013 in the Philippines, and then that has expanded and we branched out into a number of other countries such as Indonesia, Mali, Nigeria, and we're also working in Pakistan. But the thing that ties it all together is working on the topic of violent extremist offenders after they've been arrested. So mainly working in prisons, but also looking at the connection of between prisons and the after prison work. So how can you already focus on reintegration after prison, and how can you include families, but also local communities, in some cases, local leaders, religious leaders, also already in rehabilitation programs in prison. So that's the ICCT part of the work. In other countries, meaning anything but my home country in the Netherlands, and at Leiden University, I do some projects also focusing on reintegration in the Netherlands, and teaching, and a lot of research connected to this topic. And that's, of course, also how I was faced with the issue of what to do with juveniles specifically, being one subgroup, of course, of the overall group of either terrorist offenders or just the whole question of how should we view them in the first place.
So the research report you wrote a couple months ago focused on children who were members of the Islamic State or whose parents were members and they were sort of brought along with them. Could you start by sort of talking a little bit about how does the Islamic State view children?
Yeah, basically you could say they view them in two ways. The first of which is they're very much viewed as the future generation, the future of the caliphate. And then second, they're also very much viewed in a very utilitarian way as cannon fodder or as soldiers or as tools to be used in the battle against the West, in the battle against the coalition fighting IS in the caliphate. So it depends, of course, on the age and it depends on the willingness of children. But what we know from research into ISIS propaganda, into IS use of children, into children who have come back from IS territory is that they were either at a very young age already very much used as potential soldiers, trained and learned to fight. Children have been used in large numbers as suicide bombers as well. Children have been deliberately used also in propaganda videos as the perpetrators of violence. So both very much as the future generation, the future also of the caliphate, very literally, and at the same time also very much used as a tool in building that caliphate.
And in those two roles, where they see them as both the future and in a utilitarian way, do you see a distinction in how ISIS views children of foreigners versus those that whose parents are Iraqi and Syrian? I mean, and what I mean by that is, do you see them somehow segregating those children into those two roles? Or how do they decide to segregate those children into those two roles? Which are those that they see as the next generation, and which do you see are kind of disposable and utilitarian? Is there any method to that?
Yeah. To be honest, we don't know that much about it. Based on the research from returnees, both juveniles but also mature adult returnees, we know that they basically put them in groups together, usually based on age. In some cases, it's very hard to determine age. So they're somewhat put together in groups ranging roughly across 2 to 3 years. Young children are first put in school, and it's very much based, as far as we know, on IQ, intelligence, the willingness to fight, talent to fight. What we do know, more generally speaking, is that just as they've used foreign terrorist fighters to specifically address their own home audiences in ISIS propaganda, they also have done that when it comes to children. So they've used British children as the perpetrators, the killers in videos specifically addressing the UK home audience. And we've seen them doing that with a number of children in other propaganda videos as well. So it seems that it's very much not so much focused generally on what country are they from and what do we do with them, but more on addressing home audiences of some of the foreign terrorist fighter juveniles, as well as talent for fighting and willingness to use violence.
And do we have a sense of how many foreign children are currently in, let's say, in IS or ISIS territory, or at least maybe in ISIS control now that they've lost a lot of territory? And of those, do we have a sense of where maybe the bulk of them come from? Do many of them come from specific countries or regions, or is it spread out fairly uniformly?
Yeah. The short answer to that would be no, we don't. We simply don't know. It's very hard, especially for children, to have the hard statistics or to have the correct numbers, partially because when we talk about children, you can basically split that up into two groups. First of all, the ones that were brought there by their parents, and second, the ones that were born there. And especially that second group is very hard to have a good guesstimate, so to speak. I've seen lots of different numbers. A couple of researchers, Mia Bloom, for example, has done quite a lot of research analyzing propaganda videos, and her team tried to make an estimate based on that, and they came to a ballpark figure of 3,000 to 7,000 children. I've seen estimates much higher than that. On the other hand, if I look, for example, at my own home country, the Dutch counterterrorism coordinator, together with our intelligence services, they estimate that there is about 70 Dutch children in IS territory, half of them brought there and half of them born there. Basically, we don't have those numbers ready.
So when we're talking about some of these children coming back to their home countries or maybe emigrating to new countries, has some of that already begun? Do we already get a sense that some children that were either born there or brought there for some period of time are returning?
Yeah, we've seen that in a couple of countries, but that's also why there is now this renewed attention generally for what do we do when they come back, partially for rehabilitation, reintegration at large, and then specifically for children. So far, it's been very much under the radar and very much on a case-by-case country in most countries that we looked at in our research, and countries do use specific approaches. So in the Netherlands, we've got a handful of children and very different cases. We've had a couple of women, mothers, who came back specifically to the Netherlands to give birth. So in the end, those children were born here. We've had mothers and families coming back all together, bringing children that were born there and children that they brought there. We've seen, for example, in Chechnya that there has been much more of an effort on account of the government to actually proactively try and get the children back, to return children to Chechnya. So the approaches have been very different all around the world, but the numbers haven't been that high yet that we've seen any generalized approaches across the globe.
And in your report, you identified some issues that seemed unique to the question of sort of reintegrating some of these children to their home countries. I was wondering if you could maybe summarize a couple of those that you saw as most important.
Yeah, of course, because the main question for us was also, we have a lot of knowledge and there's a lot of programs out there in different countries that focus on reintegrating, rehabilitating terrorist offenders. But what do we really know about how to reintegrate and rehabilitate juveniles? And especially this group, IS really presents a whole new challenge in that they actually occupy territory for quite some time and that they established a very pervasive totalitarian culture of violence in which these children have grown up to a certain extent. So that's something new to deal with. So first of all, we wanted to know what's out there, what are countries doing now? And at the same time, we wanted to know what lessons can we learn also from related fields that might apply to this group. And I think the two main things that stood out for us were the importance of age and the importance of attitudes. First of all, related to the first question of how does IS use and perceive children and juveniles in their territory? And a lot is based on their age as well. And very generally speaking, you can kind of make a distinction between 0 to 7, 8, 9 year olds that are still very much seen as children and have gone to school and have been trained but haven't been used yet in fighting. And then there is a second group, say 8, 9 years old to about 13, 14 years old, that have already been perpetrating violence, that have been involved in fighting, that have been involved in suicide missions, but very much still in a very, at a very young age, so very much not yet fully formed and clearly not yet fully responsible for their own acts. And then there's, of course, a difficult group of more teenagers, say 14, 15 plus years old, a number of which have voluntarily chosen to travel to IS territory and a number of which have been brought there at a bit younger age, but who are much more already self-aware, who sometimes chose certain roles themselves. So age matters a lot in determining how to deal with them when they come back and what roles they might have fulfilled. And then attitudes, two things stood out there. First of all, the importance of how they view violence. They've been accustomed, they've been socialized into this culture of violence, and it's very, very important to find out what their opinions are on the use of violence. There is some interesting research done specifically on the topics of youth and delinquency, and one of those researchers concludes it's a research by Zhang Loeber and Stauthammer Loeber, and they analyzed the relationship between delinquency and attitudes and behavior, and their main conclusion basically says that youths who have a tolerant attitude toward violence are much more likely to be deviant or likely to engage in future criminal behavior than counterparts who actually engage in violence. So basically that tells us that aside from whether they did actually participate in the use of violence, it's more important to find out how they feel about violence, to get a grip, an idea of how much they accept the use of violence. So what is the extent of their socialization into that culture? Yeah, and one other thing, and that's more the matter of how do they deal with what they've experienced. So on the one hand, it's about what is their age? What role have they potentially filled in their time there? Two, what are their attitudes towards violence? And three, how do they currently deal with what they've experienced? And there we point to the importance of internalization versus externalization when it comes to behavior. And that's basically saying internalizing behaviors, that refers to children who direct their feelings and emotional responses inward. And we know from a lot of research that that is actually also much more of a risk. And that's a bit counterintuitive, I'd say, that when you have children who return and who are very aggressive, maybe, or very openly dealing with trauma, can't sleep, have nightmares, behave in a very angry and emotional way, that's very much externalizing behavior. And on the one hand, you might think that that's the most worrying behavior and that we should pay special attention to those children, whereas research actually tells us that the opposite is true, that it's actually very healthy if that happens, and that we should definitely devote more attention to those children who internalize, so who do not necessarily show any outward signs of what they've experienced or how they're dealing with it.
Wow, very interesting. When you're talking about that, it really struck me in your report, you had mentioned that these children need to be viewed in some cases both through the lens of victims and threats. And as you're talking about how what may be more important is not just what acts they committed, but how they feel about those acts, it really sort of struck me how this process of reintegration really, it sounds like you're saying, needs to be separate from a criminal justice prosecutorial position, right? Or like they may be totally different. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, well, first of all, we already have the difficulty of when juveniles come back, one risk is that they're very much viewed as potential evidence providers, also providing evidence that might help prosecuting their parents or their brothers and sisters, and also potentially, of course, providing evidence for what they've done themselves. And that usually is kind of like the age-old debate between, on the one hand, the focus on reintegration, and the other hand, the focus on repression. So, as a general rule, we believe that people should be punished for their acts. But of course, when it comes to children, the question is, how old were they? To what extent are they responsible for what they might or might not have done? And for reintegration, that's a very sensitive and delicate matter when it comes to children, because when you really want to know how they view violence, how they basically reflect on their own experiences, and especially with young children, that's already in and of itself a difficult thing to find out, and that takes time and that takes building trust. And then you might hear some very gruesome things that they might have participated in already at a very young age. So you, to a certain extent, need to be able to handle that and to deal with that without right away going into prosecution mode, so to speak, or to the whole mode of what do we do with those potential offenses that they might have committed.
So you also in your research indicate or predict that a lot of the practices that are already in place for sort of treating juveniles who may be gang members or involved in criminal activity otherwise will be effective with children who are returnees from the Islamic State. Is that correct, first of all? And what do you think would apply and what do you think might not work as well?
Yeah, basically, because that's similar to what we found when we look more generally to the whole population of terrorist offenders. So generally, what do we do different when it comes to reintegrating terrorists compared to reintegrating regular criminals? And then we found that the majority of what we do is actually very similar to what we do for general offenders as well. So the same applies for children. I think specifically looking at lessons that we can learn from DDR programs, so for child soldiers, for example. What's different, of course, about IS, as I just said, is that children actually grew up in a very pervasive culture of violence, and that's something that's very much different from other types of experience children might have had. For example, children who might have grown up in a family where abuse has been common, or children who might have grown up being involved in criminal activities. That's different from growing up in an entire culture of violence where everyone around you is also part of that culture, that same culture. So that's what sets it apart, but that is still very similar to what a lot of child soldiers have experienced. So there's a lot we can learn from that. And then at the same time, there are some common elements, for example, children dealing with trauma from abuse or sexual abuse, also young children. A lot of it is applicable to this group of children returnees as well, because there it's also about trying to draw out their experience, trying to create and establish trust with them, for them to talk about what they might have experienced in a very non-judgmental way, and trying to basically determine how they view what has happened. So that's again, very similar.
And in your report, you talk about how the Islamic State really methodically socializes children to violence. And you talked a little bit about what might be sort of risk factors later in life, whether they internalize their experience and feelings or externalize that. Certainly of returning children, there will be some that will be at higher risk of further violence as they get older, whether it's ideological or not. Any thoughts on how that risk can be addressed?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we very much need to relate it to the larger issue of did they come back with family members and what's the state generally of their family members. And there's now a lot of talk generally of even now that the caliphate has crumbled pretty much, What does that mean? We don't lose the ideology, of course. And for a lot of people that have been engaged in the caliphate, that when there is foreign terrorist fighters, this will always present for them a period of camaraderie, of fighting for a higher goal. So there might be a lot of older returnees that will always, to a certain extent, stick to this period, or that this period will always, to them, represent a very important, maybe most fulfilling period in their lives. So it's especially important to look at not just children independently, but children in those families, I think, run a much higher risk, because they might have already grown up in that culture. But if you then, on top of that, live in a family with parents and maybe older brothers and sisters that all were there as well, and actually all see that period as the highlight of their lives and something where they really wish it would have been successful in the end, that would be much of a higher risk. So that's more related to the environment of children. And then the other thing I think is very much focused on, as I said, some children might come back and might have literally been involved in killing people and might have killed scores of people. But it's more important to actually keep track of how they start perceiving their time there over time. So it's really a matter of monitoring their attitudes over a long period of time. And I think the biggest risk is those children that have internalized already that culture of violence and view that as the normal culture and have a hard time stepping away from that. And what you can do there, well, if it's in families, I think we really need to very seriously consider the option of actually taking children away from their own family members, because they might be better placed in foster families or foster care. Yeah, also to prevent future risk.
And as you were researching this issue, I'm wondering if you've seen anyone, either from a national government perspective or a local government or maybe an NGO, do you see anyone who you think is getting it right or is preparing to get it right if and when children return to their area?
Yeah, I thought about that question. And as I said, one thing that we found when we did the research, looking basically all around the world, saying what do countries do with juvenile terrorists right now? So not necessarily returnees, but any terrorist juveniles. We found that there is hardly any country that has specific programs for children. They either treat them as adult offenders or they treat them as their juvenile regular criminal counterparts. So there's hardly any countries with specific facilities. What we do see now, which I think is a promising development, is that in most countries in Europe, governments seem to take very much the case-by-case approach, which in a way is a very boring answer, but basically they're saying we are not going to have an overall approach to juveniles because it's going to be so very different, what cases we have, because there will be some that have been born there, and some of the returnees that have been born there might have two Dutch parents, but they also might have a Dutch and a German parent, and one parent might have stayed behind, and one parent might have deceased, and another is still alive. Then there is the somewhat older children. Some children come back without families. Some children come back after they have themselves chosen to go there. So because there are so many different situations, and then also when they come back, in what state do they come back, and what state is their family in when they come back? Do they have any other relatives left? Do they have a network that they can use when they come back? So most governments seem to take a case-by-case approach, which I think is the best thing you can do. Basically not saying this is our general approach, but when they come back, first thing we try to do is get a clearer picture of what state they're in. There, I do think it's very important to, as I said, not in the first sense see them as potential providers of evidence to prosecute either them or their parents, because that can also in the long term be a very counterproductive approach. And the other thing I think is good to note is that there are some programs out there. For example, Pakistan has set up a de-radicalization program called Sabayoon, specifically directed at reintegrating children from Taliban families. And that has a pretty good track record. And that's, in a certain extent, it's not entirely applicable because it functions a bit as an orphanage, because these are just children without parents. But what they do in practice, the interventions they use, those are very interesting to look at, I think, for countries who are struggling to design programs for juveniles.
Finally, I'm wondering if you could recommend to our listeners where they could go for further information on this topic or recommendations you might have. We're going to link to your report in our show notes, but anything else, any other sources or researchers or NGOs or agencies that you think are worth diving deeper into on this topic?
Yeah, definitely. A couple of things. There's a lot of NGOs around the world who generally do a lot of work with juveniles, who then now also include working with juvenile returnees. Always a good start point are organizations such as International Red Cross, ICRC, but also Mercy Corps. They do a lot of work with juvenile terrorist offenders in different countries as well. Then, of course, you're already linking to the article, but we did a joint report, ICT, together with Global Center, where we describe what countries do now worldwide. And so that will be an interesting one to look at. And then I think, generally speaking, a lot of IS returnees, both juvenile and adult returnees, now seem to be stuck in camps and in prisons in neighboring countries of Syria and Iraq. So a lot of them are currently in Kurdish territory and in Turkish territory, Jordan, Lebanon, and either in prisons or in camps. So that's not necessarily a source of literature, but more it's very interesting to keep track of media reports of what's going on there. We've heard some very troubling news about the circumstances in some of these prisons and camps. But I think one of the first things we need to focus on is not so much what do we do when they come back here, but it's very likely that a lot of them might stay there for a long time. So how can we already start doing work with them in prisons and in camps close to the current territory?
Dr. Haida, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me. And also for your listeners, you can always feel free to contact me if you have any further questions or suggestions of what we should look at in our research.
Excellent. We hope to talk to you again.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.